This is Andrew Iden, and you're listening to The Cave of Solitude. Welcome back, everybody, to The Cave of Solitude, your comic book and pop culture podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. This is episode 110. And recently, myself and my lady, Lady J, ventured to New York City for our familial pilgrimage that we are known to take to New York. And many moons ago, we, in the early days of the Cave of Solitude, it was episode 10 where we recorded sitting on top of the Rockefeller Center overlooking Manhattan. And now, 100 episodes later, we celebrate once again in the Big Apple. Now, this is a two-parter episode, one where you'll find me and Daft J walking the streets of NYC and being up to our usual hijinks. It's a lot of fun as we talk all things NYC. But this first installment is a real privilege for me to be able to share. By pure happenstance, the weekend that we were visiting New York, it was also the weekend of Mocha Fest, which celebrates comic art and indie creators, similar to Toronto's TCAF. But I was able to convince Lady J to attend because the co-creators of one of her absolute favorite books, not just comic books, but favorite books, the March Trilogy, which tells the true story of Congressman John Lewis, who is the last living member of what they call the Big Six of civil rights leaders during the civil rights movement, the two co-authors were there. Now, we just wanted to attend their panel, but I took a shot and asked if I could interview them for our show. Both artist Nate Powell and writer Andrew Iden agreed, and if I never do another interview again, that's okay, because I'm so thrilled to have been able to chat with both of these gentlemen. So this episode will be heard in three segments. First is with artist Nate Powell. Then, when you hear the music cue in, we march over to the hotel where the panel would be hosted. Then we march back to the con floor, where we walk the con floor with Andrew Iden to close out the show. Now, I really encourage everybody, if you haven't, go to your local comic book shop, get the March Trilogy, because it's a beautiful book, it's very well written, and it's a great lesson in history and a lot of things that are pertinent to the world we live in today. And I hope that you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed being able to share it with you. So without further ado, this is episode 110, part 1, marching through New York City at Mocha Fest with Nate Powell and Andrew Iden. Okay, we are here at the MoCA in NYC, and I have the privilege now of being able to talk to Nate Powell, the renowned artist and writer of such books as The March Trilogy, Swallow Me Whole. What else we got on the table here?
Any Empire, You Don't Say, and then my new book that's coming out this summer is Come Again.
Come Again, awesome. So it's a real privilege to meet you and to be able to talk to you. How are you enjoying the show so far?
It's been fantastic. Actually, MoCA in 2003 was my first, major indie comic con, and it was the first time one of my books that wasn't self-published got to debut at a show. So MoCA is always meaningful to me, and it's kind of a nice full circle experience.
And in regards to indie comic shows, how many are there around in the country that you're able to attend? Do you prefer the indie shows, or do you ever go to the big shows?
Well, yeah, I go to San Diego Comic Con every year, and I've gone to Dragon Con and a bunch of other big ones. My heart is certainly with the mid-level indie cons. Before I was a dad, I probably went to 10 or 15 shows a year. Now it's probably about half that. Just it's hard to get away with two small kids.
Right, right.
But it's got to be done. And it's revitalizing to kind of physically embed yourself with your community, your scene again,
Right. Have you ever been, by chance, to TCAF in Toronto?
Oh, that TCAF is TCAF is tied for the best show in North America. I think Small Press Expo and TCAF are really peak shows. Yeah.
I'm from Toronto, And I haven't ever had the chance of going to TCAF yet, just for scheduling purposes. This year will be my first time. Will you be there?
Unfortunately, not this year. But yeah, you got to go. It's so wonderful.
Definitely going this year. So, what's your history a little bit into comic books themselves? Were you a comic book fan as a child, or was it something that you got into artistically later on?
Yeah, well, I started reading comics when I was 3, and a lot of that was because in 1981, Wonder Woman, the Hulk, and Spider-Man were all on TV simultaneously, right. And so that was my in, was Wonder Woman. And I started drawing at age 3 also, but I didn't really put those two interests together until I had a friend who had been drawing comics for a couple of years already. And we were hanging out one summer right after 6th grade. And he's like, wait, we need to draw comics together. And it was like I had never thought of it. And all of a sudden, you know, I was like, oh, this is such a no-brainer. I can't believe that I haven't already done this. And it was kind of, we just really got down to business and never looked back. So I started self-publishing in 9th grade and just kind of, like, figured out the value of, like, discipline, how to divvy up my time, and just kind of carried it forth. Yeah,
that's amazing. Did you ever have the dream or desire to work for like the big two, or did you prefer doing your own creative, having your own creative outlet with nobody kind of putting you in a box?
Well, yes. I mean, when I, like, growing up, all the way up until college, I guess, growing up in Arkansas, pre-internet, you know, there really wasn't much of... I had virtually no awareness of comics that were outside of maybe the big 4 publishers.
Right.
So as I became less interested in superhero comics, I didn't yet have the awareness that there were other ways of telling stories,
right,
for things that were freshly important to me.
Right.
But in the latter half of the 90s, I went to school here in New York City and got exposed to a lot of graphic novels and yeah, some more like indie cartooning. To this day, you know, a lot of my peers and friends, they work for some of the big 2, big 3 companies.
Right.
And every once in a while, we'll collaborate. And, you know, on occasion, I've done stuff for, like, DC Vertigo or Marvel or whoever. But, yeah, a lot of it's finding a balance. I make a living as a cartoonist also. And, you know, like, it's like a different specific struggle for each cartoonist to try to make their own living. So if people are able to do that with big 2 work, then by all means, they should do that. I don't know. I think it's right now is just a really good time for comics as a community to sort of see the big pond that encompasses the larger companies as well as smaller presses as a means of keeping the whole boat afloat.
Yeah, you realize nowadays that there isn't a story that can't be told with this medium. Because it's not really a genre. People used to associate comic books as being superheroes. But now you see books literally about everything you can imagine. And it's some of the most fulfilling ways to read a story, because it's using both sides of the brain and you can do it at your own pace, I find. So speaking of that, March is obviously the book that you're very well celebrated for. How did you get into the making of March? What was it like working with John Lewis? How closely did you get to work with him?
I mean, it's, you know, we grew close, you know, as friends and collaborators. And so over the course of those 4 years of drawing the book, half the time, every other weekend or every weekend, we would be doing talks and signings in cities all across the country. So we'd work together while we were, you know, like I'd be asking story questions while we're eating breakfast or while we're waiting to speak. And he's a fantastic dude. Andrew and Congressman Lewis worked on the script before I came on board. And I was wrapping up 2 other books around 2010, 2011 when I saw the press release for March. And I tried out for the role of artist. And we just clicked almost immediately. It's been a, you know, transformative experience.
That's incredible. I think someone needs you to sign their books for them.
Oh, sure. This way.
So continuing with March, this is... what would seem to be a subject that, you know, 50 years ago it was, the civil rights movement was a big thing, but it when you look at today, it's such a timely story to be told. So when you were going through this, the creation of this book and listening to John Lewis's accounts, how familiar were you already with the civil rights? Were you already interested in it, or was this something that you saw that someone approached you and thought your work would be right for it?
Both are true and have their own exceptions. So I'm from Arkansas. My family's from Mississippi. I also grew up in Alabama. And my parents are baby boomers. So I grew up with a very basic working knowledge of the civil rights movement and grew up literally down the street from a lot of landmarks. But it wasn't, and the subject matter and even historical components worked their way into stories that I did just prior to March as well. However, it wasn't until I dove in all the way to do March that I realized, A, how much of that basic working knowledge of history I took for granted was a part of every American kid's experience growing up. Also, it made me realize that a generational shift had occurred, that I was 35 years old at the time, and there are 15-year-olds in school, and that their parents might be my age and are one generation further divorced from that immediate first-person account of that history. But also, the more I had to, you know, read the research and listen to and read about accounts, the more I recognized that I was, that what I knew was closer to what the Southern Poverty Law Center calls the 9 words problem, which is that most kids know 9 words about the civil rights movement: Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream. And not to be that absolute, but it was really shocking the depth, the complexities, the contradictions, like the messy real work of revolution. And so a lot of it was, I was like, I don't know anything. Like, my life as a Generation X Southerner, like, my perception of what I know about the movement is a lie. Yeah. And so it was profoundly affecting. And, I mean, to this day, it's like, once I got a taste of diving further and further into that history and that context, it's like, it never quite goes away. I'm still reading history books about it, and I finished March, you know, 2 years ago.
Exactly. So did you have a particular process in regards to how you laid out the pages for this book? And because so much of it takes place with specific dates and a timeline of factual things that happen. And one of the things I enjoyed about it, I was telling to my wife, was in the scenes where there's a lot of action and activity and there's lots of crowds, there's those thought balloons with the little scribbles and a one or two words that are stated to kind of give you the feeling of hearing ambient noises in words and things like that. And so how did you approach that attacking of the page to give us that concept of time in the moment?
Well, a lot of those, I guess on a formal level, a lot of those techniques that I was using, I sort of forged way back with Swallow Me Whole, which came out in 2008. And a lot of that, like, especially the use of, like, ambient sound, conveying it visually to kind of like fill out a larger picture. A lot of those techniques had to embed themselves into March, but at the same time, because we had a responsibility, you know, for like accurate storytelling, to present this as history, as it's being taught, you know, the books are being taught in class as history, so like we have to walk a tight line. So there were new limitations on what can and cannot be, you know, outright quoted. You know, like it became harder and harder to like just make up, you know, random crowd exaltation, you know, like random crowd speech.
Was that hard for you guys to be two white men telling the story of this and having to illustrate or show even the dialogue that was being used back then? Was that difficult or uncomfortable for you guys?
Well, I mean, at times, definitely difficult, always uncomfortable, but it's, you know, like, it requires a constant reminder that it's not about me and the way I feel drawing it, but also, there are particular moments, yeah, like, you have to I would have to recognize at the drawing table when I needed to, like, call it a day after a particularly intense page or panel, and I just need to like go pet my cat or whatever.
Right.
But also, there are these moments, particularly like as a white artist, doing this account of of John Lewis and his peers, where I would have to return to embrace the fact that, you know, that Congressman Lewis chose me to tell his story through his eyes and in his words. And really that did, the fact that, like, coming back to, like, the reassurance, and, like, Congressman Lewis is so supportive, and that helped more than anything. So a lot of that is anxiety about that precise situation, more than any real concern, like, more than a concrete concern. It's anxiety in the air. And so once that anxiety dissipates, you're like, oh, I've got a job to do.
Right.
Let's do this.
So in regards to John Lewis, I'm not sure if he has already written an autobiography like many of his contemporaries would have, but what made him choose this format to tell his story?
Sure. Well, in 98, he released a fantastic memoir called Walking with the Wind. 10 years later, when Andrew was a relatively new staffer in his office during the 2008 campaign election cycle, basically, some folks in the office were mildly making fun of him for being a comic book nerd. John Lewis stood up for him, and he was like, don't make fun of him. When I was a teenager, there was a comic book that was very influential in the civil rights movement that was about the Montgomery bus boycotts. It came out in 1957. Top Shelf has since reprinted it. But Andrew had never heard of it. At the time, it had sort of fallen into obscurity. But he researched it that night online. And then he started getting sort of possessed by the fact that, like, every question they had, like, how do we reintroduce the history and context of the movement to new generations? How do we get young people active in, you know, the social and political processes that hold everything together? The answer to every question they were all trying to figure out together, Andrew kept being like, crazy idea. I still think you should make a comic, Congressman. And John Lewis, you know, he politely shot him down for a couple of months. But Andrew is very persistent. So one day he was like, all right, if you do it with me. But for Andrew, like, it was like a lightning bolt, you know, like, it to him, he had the sort of, like, far reaching vision where he saw a graphic novel of young people's, you know, actions in the movement as being the answer to virtually every question they had about, you know, how to tackle these issues of history, continuity, participation, context, yeah, empowerment. Yeah.
And it's such a powerful format, like we said, because you read it, and comic books are oftentimes you associate with something fictional or fantasy. But then when I'm reading this book and I see some of the illustration, I'm like, wait a second. He actually got a baseball bat in the head. Like, this is extremely powerful stuff to know that even though this is cartooned, this is real.
It was weird, like, being a cartoonist, but also being somebody who's read comics my whole life. Some of those, I don't know, like, the visual language by which we're all used to seeing physical violence in comics, it's so deeply embedded in, like, you know, the way that we read comics and enjoy them, that it required a bit of a reckoning anytime those situations would happen. Because, like, you didn't want to sterilize, you know, you didn't want to sanitize or whitewash any of the violence, but you also wanted to avoid a visual depiction of that violence, which might be exploiting the human cost, you know? And so really a lot of it is, you know, you put in the time and you figure out exactly what that middle ground is, a way to be expressive and do good comics, but a way to also be responsible and unflinching. Yeah.
Right. Now, all of your books I flipped through, they're done in black and white, correct? I thought perhaps that March, was there a choice to have it done in black and white, or was there ever an idea to do it in color, or is it more powerful to be in black and white?
After the first book came out, there was like 2 days where the idea was floated to do it color from then on. But A, I love drawing black and white comics. B, the book I did before March, The Silence of Our Friends, is also a period piece, mostly nonfiction, interwoven with the movement. But the gray washes that I incorporated into that book, sort of that whole book is like a blueprint which allowed me to do March and hit the ground running. Also, you know, like, Mark's a very successful book, but in general, there isn't a lot of money in comics.
Right.
So as a matter of, like, time being money, it would have taken, it'll take me twice as long to do a color page than black and white.
Right.
And if I need to do 10 pages a week, then I need to do 10 pages a week.
Yeah,
so it was
a heavy work.
Yeah, it's so a lot of it was practical, but also for anybody born after 1970, the way that we, as two or three generations of people, relate to the past before 1970 is through photography and video that is virtually all black and white. And as much as it was my mission to kind of destroy that level of abstraction from, like, when I would look at photography and video even as a kid, and I would understand that it was real and that it, you know, like, maybe it was something that happened just 10 years before I was born, but it had this layer of unreality to it, like it wasn't part of the same continuity that we live in. So I wanted to destroy that sense of abstraction, that disconnect. But that is the way we relate to past history, and so I needed to sort of respect the way that our brains work when we're processing history.
Yeah, that's great. So before we go, can you tell us a little bit about the book that you have coming out this summer?
Sure. Well, it is actually my first color book, now that you mention it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's called Coming In. It takes place in 1979 in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. And it's in a dried up hippie village where most of the people have packed up and moved back to the regular world. It's the story of a couple of families who stayed behind, who now have kids of their own. A lot of it's about secrecy, intimacy, and privacy in an environment in which you can have virtually none of that if the community is going to survive. And it's the ways that it's a human need to carve out that private space. It's also about the terror of casualness in a time of crisis. So, like, a lot of it's a horror story. It has, like, some strong Ray Bradbury Twilight Zone vibes.
Okay.
And it's the way that it's the horror of watching a community, fall under a spell which prevents their being able to respond to a crisis in a real and meaningful way. So, there's a lot of stuff about parenting in there. But mostly it's, like, a lot of demons and terror.
Sounds interesting. So when can we expect it to hit the stores?
July.
All right, everybody. Stay on the lookout for that. Thank you so much for giving us of your time. We're looking forward to the panel later on today, and enjoy the rest of your time in New York.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
By people that volunteer their weekends, that they could be spending looking at all of the amazing mini comics and graphic novels, or participating in programs like this, but they're giving their time to ensure that we're able to have these kinds of exchanges. So I'd also like to invite a round of applause for the great volunteers to make this event happen. Thank you. Thank you for the gracious introduction, Bill. I'm Charles Brownstein. I am the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and have had the great opportunity to delve into the incredible achievement that Andrew and Nate have made in the March Trilogy as the co-curator of the Art of March event that's happening at Society of Illustrators right now. And what's astonishing looking at this book in this historical moment where youth is now finding its voice so stridently is that this is a graphic novel embodying everything about the First Amendment. It is a work of speech and press about assembly and petition as informed by religion. It is a book that embodies what it is to be an American that is speaking truth to power using the mechanisms at their disposal. And it is a work that is instructive not only for the history it covers, but for the example it provides, which we are now seeing every weekend as youths take to the street and speak to the matters of urgent concern to them. And so I would like to open this program asking about the activist roots of both Andrew and Nate and how those ethics affected you in taking on the challenge of March.
Okay, I guess, Mike, would you like?
Oh, right.
For me, I guess my entry point into activism came from getting involved with the very vibrant underground do-it-yourself punk scene, particularly in Little Rock, Arkansas, my hometown, from the late 80s to today. Very powerful, interwoven, active, creative community, but starting really with like lyrics of that I would read on records and tapes, like as a 13-year-old, and then seeing some applications from some of the older members of my punk scene throughout high school, like as getting to see really from grassroots stuff, like doing pirated free shows with local bands, but using that as an opportunity to do a Food Not Bombs, clothing drive, feeding homeless folks, doing all these, including the shows, in a public free setting, and sort of dealing with law enforcement and city officials along the way throughout that process. And then moving from that into protesting, Klan rallies and white supremacist gatherings, in Little Rock, and when I went to school here in SBA, even, as a Southerner moving up to New York City, being like, wait, the Klan is going to try to rally in New York City? And I'd say that moving into the late 90s, anti-globalization, IMF, WTO, World Bank, movements and culture and the way that that moved into the anti-war movement of the early 2000s, punk was really my entry point. But it also provided 10 years later for a good way to assess a lot of things I took for granted and a lot of incorrect assumptions I had about mass protest that really I only was forced to check and re-examine once I dove into the full history and context of the movement. Doing the reading, doing the homework for March, and it was really powerful to realize what spontaneously the young people who I grew up around got right, but then a lot of the misconceptions and baggage that I carried with me until I was 35 years old, I think.
I guess my activist roots have to be traced back to my mother. I was raised by a single mom. And my father left when I was 3, and he was a Muslim immigrant, which is super popular right now. The president's always talking about you.
Ooh.
You get all this extra attention when you fly. I'm kidding, it's okay. But when you grow up with a single mom, you don't see things quite the same way. Because the systemic discrimination against women in general, but against a mother in particular because of the extra challenges they face, sensitizes you to the systemic inequalities in our system. And I can remember being very young and my mother not sugarcoating any of it. And just explaining why she was having to face some of the things she was having to face. Just even problems in her custody battle, and the way the judges or the lawyers would treat her. Little lady stuff. And then, as I got older, it informed a great deal of what I got interested in. By the time I got to college, I got elected to student government my freshman year. I was that kid. And when we couldn't get something through legislative means, I was not afraid to hold a protest against the administration. In fact, my first sit-in was in college to force the administration to keep the library open longer because the kids who needed it were the scholarship kids like me, and we were all packed into sardines in these single rooms. We didn't have a quiet place to study during finals, and no place to use a printer because I couldn't afford a printer ink in college. And we had a sit-in, and we forced the administration to keep the library open 24 hours a day during exams just by occupying it. And then I started protesting. I can get into this policy, but it was a bill called the Clean Cars Bill. Back before emission standards were what they are now, one of the ways that you could force the tri-state area, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, to adopt a new higher standard was to get it passed in Connecticut because all the car dealers shared inventory between the three states. And so I led a legislative campaign my junior year of college down in the state capitol to force them to pass this bill that would implement a higher standard and put extra things on cars. And that's actually what led me into politics. I think the guy who was running the state senate, later became the lieutenant governor, would have rather had me inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. And he offered me a job. And that's what led to me being in government. But it was all rooted in activism and a sense of fairness that was not recognized in our society, and the belief that my mother instilled in me that I could do something about it. So that's...
It's intriguing to listen to the directions that you've come to this, and it's actually a perfect marriage of interest to create the graphic novel March, in so much as, Nate, your grassroots background informs so much of the physicality of March. You stood in those marches. You understand what it is to be in a police mob, not to the extent, of course, that the congressman had to suffer, but certainly a lot of the moments that you describe with your pen, you know, are things that are lived experience coming through. And Andrew, on the other hand, you know, you clearly understand the backroom skullduggery that has to go on to achieve an activist means, you know, through the system. So could you speak to how your disparate and some might say divergent activist roots inform the ability to collaborate on a book about really marrying those two aspects of petitioning for change?
Well, from my standpoint, that's one of the specific points that I was oblivious to until it came time to start, well, to start with Walking with the Wind and really reckon with, so I'm from Arkansas. I also grew up in Alabama during elementary school. My parents are from Mississippi. So, like, I grew up with this very basic working knowledge of the civil rights movement from my parents, you know, lived and peripheral experiences, but also what they had absorbed as the accepted narrative of civil rights movement history. And I'd say that coupled with the way that I had learned, you know, direct action and protest filtered through punk had sort of made me completely miss all of the unsexy, boring, you know, nose to the grindstone work that I suddenly became like entranced by once it came time to read further about the history of the movement, and became like increasingly, particularly in March Book 3, it was personally important to me, and I know to all of us, to like to emphasize the fact that, like, you know, like when people are making plans and putting them into action, you're going to have a meeting, you're going to sit around the table, or you're going to sit in your jail cell, and like you're going to delegate, and you're going to, like, you know, come to some sort of consensus, and, you know, the amount of, like, disagreement on personal and tactical and strategic levels can be so strong, but emphasizing that, like, it's the process by which folks with considerable differences learn to continue to work together towards, and really remember what the common goal is in the first place. And that was something that was really never a part of my earlier narrative of, like, where the different stages at which change comes. You know, I was happy to, like, show up in the streets, was happy to, like, cook the food and wash the clothes and everything, but, like, I was missing this entire component of this structure that causes change.
Yeah. I guess in some ways it was as if, I'm going to use a political frame for this, but it was as if Nate was the press secretary and I was the legislative director. So he was in charge of what was going out in front of everybody, and I was in charge of making sure that everything that was coming to him was good and made sense and worked with all the other pieces, right?
Yeah.
I've been in government too long. But, you know, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, where our process changed so much between the first, second, and third books. Where in the beginning we were just trying to find each other, trying to understand where we meet. And by the third book, we had a shorthand that allowed all of us to work a whole lot faster and a whole lot more effectively. And
let's unpack that. What does that mean?
So, well, first, let's bring the additional important player here, Lee Walton, our editor.
For the second two.
Yes.
Star Wars was the editor for the first one.
Yeah. And also, like, for us creatively, you know, March Book 1, you know, covers John Lewis from age 4 to age 20. And a lot of it really is, like, it's much more, like, personal, subjective narrative. And the historical, you know, moments of activism are not as well documented. I mean, part of the story of March is the story of the way that media was able to cover the movement to explode it into the national consciousness, to force a national discussion. So, creatively, in terms of making these comics, that gave, like, a lot of wiggle room to, you know, like, doing March Book 1, for me at the drawing table, was a lot like me just, like, drawing any empire or Swallow Me Whole. It was a lot of this young person having these strange experiences in a rural landscape or in a suburban landscape, and there wasn't the same level of accountability. But then over the process, so
it was like the tryout pages.
Yeah, yeah.
So when Nate tried out, he had to do the scene where John Lewis first meets Martin Luther King, which I thought was somewhat cruel to have that be a first page. But Star Wars wanted to see you draw.
Yeah, yeah.
Martin Luther King and John Lewis and Ralph Abernathy. And there was that moment where John Lewis tells the story and he says, "I met Dr. King, so I said my whole name. I am John Robert Lewis." And he actually says both of those. And when Nate did the script the first time, he was like, "Well, that's stupid. Why are you saying that first?" Which is a totally valid edit. Except that what we're trying to do is to give you the experience of John Lewis telling you these stories as he actually tells them, so that it is a primary source. It is nonfiction. It's not our interpretation of his voice. It is his voice. And so then we had to go back and redo that page, but and have that conversation. Like that's sort of the learning process of like no, I'm not repeating that in the script because I think it, you know, we want to make sure everybody knows his name. It's just that it's how we get to the point where we make a narrative that is John Lewis.
And yet you are making a creative process here, and one of the things that's really interesting is that how do you edit this guy that lived through history, and yet you have to make it really interesting,
sure,
too.
Well, also, you know, like, you've known Congressman Lewis for many moons, so when I was drawing Book 1, you know, we weren't buddies yet.
Right.
Like, I didn't know the person, John Lewis, and so
when did you first meet John Lewis?
I first met John Lewis SPX weekend 2012. So like seven.
Oh, right.
You
came by the office.
I went to the Congressional Building in the Capitol, and I was like, oh, I gotta meet the big man. Wore a 3-piece suit,
yes,
sweating my ass off. And I was like, why did I do this? And I was like, great, so great to meet you. I shouldn't have worn all this. But to back that up, like, when we're talking about that, I said my whole name. I'm John Robert Lewis.
Hey.
Knowing him now, like, so for me, like, the arc of making March is the arc of also making these two friends who are my collaborators as well. So, like, sometimes I'm like, like, why couldn't I redo that page right now? Because the real gist of it is, like, you know, he's kind of having, like, a Larry David moment where he's like, don't say anything stupid. Don't say anything stupid. And he's like, are you John Lewis? I'm John Robert Lewis. You know, like, if I can go back and do it in, like, a tasteful, hilarious way, like, what's happening inside his head is being like, I'm John Robert Lewis. Oh.
No, I feel the same way about Book 1 because, I mean, that was the first book I ever wrote. What did I know what I was doing?
Sure.
You know, I was the guy I'd written before. That was a radio ad or some tweets, you know, like, didn't exactly qualify me. I could be president, but...
please.
We'll get through this. We will get through this. We were so lost. But that's it, right? And I think that's kind of why Nate's idea to break it up into a trilogy was so important to the success of it. Because if we hadn't had that learning curve, if we had just said, no, we're going to go in a room and do this for 2 years, 3 years, however long it takes,
none of this would happen.
No, and like, we have fun on the road. I mean, you guys see John Lewis, and it's John Lewis.
Yeah, what's he really like?
Man.
he has, like, a major sweet tooth.
Yeah.
And, like, he, over the years, I've just now been able to like detect his like micro inflections of when he's pissed off or when he's happy.
Because he doesn't say it.
Right.
It's just up here, and you just notice the wiggle.
Like, you'll see, like, and you're like, oh, he's really happy now.
Okay, so like, what did he say? I'm like, no, he didn't say anything. Yeah. But
I'm like, what came as a, you know, what really helped put me at ease right from the get-go was the fact that the, you know, like the public persona, Congressman John Lewis, who we are familiar with, is essentially, like, that's John Lewis. And so, like, once we started to actually hang out a little bit, like, it was really nice, you know, especially, like, with well-earned distrust of public figures that we all carry to some degree, it was nice to be like, whoa, you're the real deal. Okay. And he just, he's a person, he's just a very temperate person who truly gives a sense of calm and, like, especially as a parent, I feel like, My journey in parenthood is as old as signing the contract on March. And so, like, it's been a really powerful guiding principle, not just in terms of, like, how my kids are equipping themselves for the world in relation to having the story of March and having the presence of John Lewis somewhere in their lives, but as a parent, for me, being able to just tone it down, play the long game, and get my priorities straight, I personally owe a lot of that to Congressman Lewis and just the example he sets.
Yeah, many a hotel room Snickers were devoured on this tour.
So yeah, why don't you explain that? Like, is this like some people at the end of the day they, you know, have a drink or something? Like, is this thing a Snickers? Is that what you're telling me?
I mean, some
like, one of the like the Konami cheat codes we've learned is that like, if we're going to go, like, talk on TV or big talk or whatever, like, one of his weaknesses is, like, a Coca-Cola with a little grenadine.
Okay, so we got to tell that whole story, then, if we're going to go just for context. Bear in mind, John Lewis and I spent years working on March with no progress, right? Every publisher saying no, all this sort of stuff. We get with Top Shelf, we get an 8, it moves forward, it might actually work. We think it's going to work. Just before book one comes out, we go to the American Library Association's Black Caucus Conference in Covington, Kentucky, which is just across the river from Cincinnati. And it's the first time we've ever sold copies of March outside of Comic-Con, right? So we're like, we don't know how librarians are going to react. So we had two cases drop shipped to the hotel, and like, we're bootleg. We're just like my friend Fanny, who runs runs part of the organization, is like just taking the money. We didn't even have Square. Right? And so we start selling them, and then we realize the line got really big, and then we realize every single person in the conference was in our line, and then we realize that they're buying more than one copy, and we realize we're not going to have enough copies for everybody, and then the ladies get mad. And like, there's like this moment of like, well, I was waiting. And rightfully so. So we had to limit it to one per person. We sell out of everything. We had to promise to send some to some people later. It was an overwhelming experience. It was the first time we really got a sense of what the demand was for March. But we hadn't really gotten any reviews from major newspapers yet. Nobody really paid attention to it. So we're feeling good after this signing. And the congressman and I are like, I'm like, congressman, let me take you to lunch. This is pretty incredible. He's like, okay. So we go to this little diner just down while we're waiting to get picked up to get taken to the airport. And then I get an email, and it's the review from the Boston Globe that just came in. And I'm, like, nervous. I'm reading it. And the first line says, like, usually when people attempt nonfiction graphic novels, they are boring, dull, and, like, all this awful stuff, right? And I'm like, oh, shit. And then I keep reading, and it says, but not so for March Book 1. And the congressman and I are sort of sitting there, and he's, like, amazed because, you know, Boston Globe, Dr. King went to college at Boston University. Like, this is, like, this is like a big thing to us, right? This is the first, comics, we have our own language, right? But breaking into the mainstream, breaking into something like the Globe or the Times, we never got reviewed in the Times, actually, until after we won the National Book Award. But getting something like that from the Globe was a huge deal to us. And so we're like over the moon celebrating, and Patrick was like, well, what should we do to celebrate? And I'm like, well, when I was a kid and I did something well, my mom would let me have a Coke with a little grenadine in it. And he's like, oh, well, that sounds good. I'll try one. So we order one. And we both drink it, and we get super hopped up on sugar. It's like so great, so we're all like, we're going to change the world. This comic book's totally going to work. It's amazing. And then we get another one, right? And we basically get about as wasted as you can get on sugar, celebrating this review and this occurrence with the Black Caucus of the ALA. And then we had to go get on a flight. I think we flew to New York after that for the next... Oh, for the kickoff when he was going to go on Colbert. That's what we flew to. And so ever since then, when we've ever had a moment to celebrate, it's been sort of a throwback to that moment of the first time. The first time we really thought that this was working. And so we celebrate with a Coke with grenadine. We get a little hopped up on sugar. Which also is a great example of how John Lewis is. Like, the guy doesn't drink, he doesn't really do anything, but, like, you know, he'll get a good sugar high.
Yeah. For the congressman and I, it's cheesecake is our jam. I see it on the menu, and I was like, he's always going to eat cheesecake. So much.
Yeah. He'll go, this is sinful.
It's always sinful.
In any biographical situation as an author, you have the challenge of not only being true to the person that is your subject, but also being true to your audience and being able to convey the events of their life in a fashion that bears some resemblance to the life of the reader. The reader may not have been part of that march, but the reader has done things in their life. They know what it is to be a private person, and they know what it is to be a public person. And one of the first rules of public life is there's what you say publicly, there's what you say privately, and there's what you think. How were you able to penetrate that wall that you're describing with the congressman to be able to provide a graphic novel that did not just convey the realities that he was a part of historically, but who he was as a person in those moments?
Well, I think our previous work history really helped. I had started in his office answering his mail, which is like the least glamorous spot you can start in, but it's incredible practice for what we were about to do because you just get used to writing in his voice. Dozens of letters a week, you know, and you're doing quite a bit. And then moving to social media and the press secretary role on his campaign and that sort of stuff. But it was on the campaign that I would get those unguarded moments where you actually get to understand, you know, where you would say the parts about people that you might not see in an official interview or a textbook. And so you get a sense of who it is that he feels strongly about and who it is that he doesn't feel strongly about. Because you see the comings and goings of the communications with people, because a lot of these guys, especially back then, were still alive. So whether it's seeing his fondness for Jim Lawson, or just sort of understanding, I mean, he doesn't hate anybody, but he really didn't particularly like Stokely Carmichael. And you get a sense of that. And so it came from a lot of practical experiences, but then I think we also built a level of trust where I could just be like, I could just ask, and like he wouldn't lie, and he would just tell me the truth. He would just be honest, and then you just put it down. And when we were able to use so many of the primary documents to see the backstory of this conflict, it all comes together to paint a more vivid picture of his own personal feelings. I think John Lewis is pretty candid as it goes, though. Right? I mean, like, before anybody else is willing to say it, he says, I don't think President Trump's a legitimate president. Right? I mean, this is...
Didn't he say that before the inauguration?
Yeah. He was just like, I'm just going to put this out here now. And that's who he is. And so I think that made my job a lot easier. Because if somebody's open and candid with you on almost all fronts, and you're trying to put that on paper, then you know where he stands.
In terms of visual storytelling and... What I refer to as pulling out content that's in between lines of the script. And a lot of this, I think I sort of dove into this when I was doing The Silence of Our Friends and working with writers to do that book. A lot of that was a boot camp for March for me. But particularly in moments that are strictly subjective and emotional, I grew up with developmental disabilities in my family. My career for 10 years was doing direct care work and advocacy for adults with disabilities and dual diagnoses, and my specialty is, you know, folks on the autism spectrum. And really a lot of the mechanisms by which I'm able to, as a professional and as a brother of somebody on the spectrum, optimally communicate with and work with someone whose brain is functioning in a different way, it has to do with approaching certain things at face value, having a different set of associative processes to like determine where people's, you know, thoughts and actions are lining up and in response to what. So like when I did Swallow Me Whole, a lot of the ways that I think I was able to pull off Ruth or Perry's characters had to do with getting my camera so close to their character, not literally, but metaphorically close enough that you're beyond a place of judgment as to their experiences and situations. You are in as much as is possible simply processing their sensory experiences. And a lot of that was directly applied to March, particularly in book one, as they were entering these terrifying situations, or in like anticipation of sneaking away on the bus to school every day, or during the Freedom Rides, these moments of terror and dread, anticipation. A lot of that had to do with, you know, sort of, you know, keeping the muscle sharp of being like, you know, as Congressman Lewis always says, you know, like, what, you know, it's one of his go-to phrases, but it has a lot of power and meaning in terms of come walk in my shoes. To take it literally, like, I have to kind of be reminded that he is not only inviting me and allowing me, but it's my job to try to walk in his shoes, regardless of, like, my generation, my skin privilege, my background. And so to sort of, like, allow myself to perform the task and exercise as much empathy and as much identification with these real people as characters in this book, I think, you know, like, I was sort of freed up once I realized that there didn't necessarily have to be anxiety or baggage associated with trying to put myself directly in the shoes of the people involved. In fact, like, that's the only way that a narrative like this can be pulled off correctly.
And how do you deal with, you used the phrase skin privilege, you know, it's not lost on anybody that we're three white men speaking about a graphic novel by one of the most prominent African-American leaders of his generation. How did you manage the position of privilege and being able to tell that story, not just in the moment of having to do your job, but in representing this story to folks, you know, every single time you're out on the road?
Sure. Well, you are probably aware of, you know, like, any like, you know, blowback or tension is certainly warranted, understandable, and, you know, like, I accept. I actually don't feel like I detect a very hot, like, I've never really detected a big level of pushback on that regard. You probably experience more of it than me in terms of, like, the broad scheme of things. But reflecting on, like, the whole March journey, I really do think that 80% of that comes down to anxiety. It doesn't come down to a concrete issue or problem. It comes down to what I'm perceiving as possibly being a problem, but which I'm still kind of like phoning in resolving the problem. And so, like, ultimately it comes down to it not being about me.
Right.
So, like, I would have to remind myself periodically that, you know, Congressman Lewis chose me to tell his story through his eyes and in his and Andrew's words. And that was my job. And so, like, you know, sometimes, like, you know, when you're particularly, like, when you're, yeah, you're telling real life experiences that are like brutal and traumatic, you know, it's right to question your place or to question my place in telling, you know, certain narratives. But then again, like, I'm telling John Lewis's story. That is my job. It's ultimately not about the way I feel about my experience drawing the book.
Yeah, I think one of the... So there was questions I remember right at the first San Diego when it came out. People would ask us, sort of like, how do you feel like being not a person of color? And then an older African-American creator wrote a column for a website, and he was like, those are two badass white boys. And I was like, oh, okay. Thank you. I think it's my mom. She was all like, I wouldn't say that, but okay. I grew up in Atlanta. Congressman Lewis has been my congressman since I was 3 years old. I went to Atlanta public schools, and then I went to private schools, and then I've been around many of these people since I was a little kid. Some of the people were depicted in the books. And I never heard these stories. And anybody could have come along and trumpeted this idea before me. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't, and I had the idea, and I could make it work, and I could figure it out, and I was willing to give my labor and my time and my energy and my soul in many ways, then that was my obligation to do it regardless of what my skin color or ethnicity may be. I had always felt, because my father was a Muslim immigrant in Atlanta, as sort of part of the other, where it is a very black and white social dynamic, and if you're not like super white, then you're on the other side. And so growing up, for me, it was always a matter of more closely identifying with the African-American experience and the white privilege experience, even if I was going to a private school on a scholarship. Because we were also poor. And I think that's something that we leave out of this sometimes, because John Lewis was also very poor growing up. And that was one of the things that I always relate to him when we would talk about, because we would... You guys ever been to Atlanta? Anybody? So, all right. So there's this place called Greenbrier Mall. And they had an outlet store. Rich's was the department store. They had an outlet store. And when I was a child, I learned math, because the only way I could get a t-shirt was if it cost less than a dollar at this outlet store. And I told the congressman this very early on. And I was like, this is how I learned to do math in my head. And he was like, oh, Mrs. Lewis used to go there all the time. And it made me, from the very outset of our relationship, realize that we had a lot of common experiences in Atlanta, being Atlantans, going to the same places. Many of them were from my childhood and from him in later life. But I never saw it as me being an outsider in that community. I am a Southerner. My relationship with the congressman has been like he's my father. And so, yeah, I'm the duck of a different color, but I always felt a part of his flock.
And this leads to, I think, a really crucial question as we look at the life of the book as it's done. It's moving off into the world. Kids have to read it in school as an assignment. Hopefully, after book one, they continue to read it and take the lessons from it. And, where do you want to see this book evolve in the upbringing of the next generation? Obviously, it can be used as a textbook of the movement, but I think there's so much more in there about who these people are, about who John Lewis was. There's that incredible moment of John Lewis and Malcolm X and their, personal moments of doubt. What are some of the human lessons you hope people carry from March as they encounter it in their personal journeys?
Well, I'd say that a lot of it, and this is actually one thing where if I could go back and do it again, we should have focused, or maybe even visually, I should have focused on this more. I think it was sort of like earth-shaking for me at the drawing table. Only then did it really hit me, the tangible youth of the people involved. And I feel like, particularly in 2018, to just see Generation Z just having enough. Just having enough. But to recognize that, like, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, John Lewis, Diane Nash, Bernard Lafayette, becoming involved as college freshmen and as high school seniors in the movement, I think it's a, you know, like, we tried in as much as we could under the circumstances to, you know, emphasize that these are young people with, like, desires, senses of humor, conflicts, selfishness. We couldn't emphasize that more, but I think, like, as a parent and seeing a bridge between new generations, I think that's one of the most powerful takeaways, particularly as, like, a Generation X Southerner with baby boomer parents who, you know, taught me a basic but, like, very convenient narrative of the movement. Like, it misses the relationship of youth, of free time, and of urgency. Like, a lot of the stuff that I felt deep in my heart that transcends a lot of the specific context that we apply very broadly. The other most important thing that I think must be carried forward, and this is another one of those reckonings I had with activism in my past, was understanding the relationship of press and the media to direct action. And coming from punk and coming from, you know, like, a anarchist / faux anarchist, showboat background, not to totally dismiss it, but, you know, like, one of the things you carry, that you hear, you kind of carry around and rattle around your head, has to do with, essentially, like, media blackout. You know, direct action is something that happens physically in the streets. Protest is a certain thing, and it doesn't involve sending out statements of intent, informing major media outlets what you're doing, where and why, what the consequence might be. I had no concept of the validation of, like, publicly fulfilling expectations as a part of protest and a part of, like, achieving your means. A lot of that was, you know, that's my immaturity at the time. But, you know, like, growing up in that 1990s, early 2000s, you know, like, radical left culture, which includes stuff like smashing cameras. You know, like, who smashes cameras? You know, white supremacists and fascists. Like, who's beating the journalists? White supremacists, far-right activists. You know, like, there's part of it that's, like, you know, it's, like, shameful and, like, haunting. And so, like, there are some ways where that's, like, that shakes me to my core and realizes, like, how easy it is, you know, to, like, just sort of, when you're not reckoning with basic ideas when they arrive at an early point, you can sort of carry that around in your head a lot, you know, for years without, you know, like, examining how you got to that point and why. That's the second most powerful takeaway, I think, Gary Gordon.
When I was starting out, and we didn't know what it was doing, and I was writing with no direction, my mom would always say, write the book for the 9-year-old you once were who was angry that his father left, so that you could have a role model. I think one of the things, if you've ever been around a single mom, they're very concerned about, particularly if it's an opposite gender child, making sure that they have a male role model to look up to. I think we've got some really despicable male role models in the government right now, and we need some very positive male role models out there. It needs to be something that young people can grow up with, that they can see that this is what a good human being actually looks like, that you have principles, you devote yourself to them, and you do not waver even when they are no longer cool. And I think that remains my goal, that every young person who needs it has a hero that is real, that is not wearing spandex or a cape, but is someone who really existed, and they understand that that person was a human being with flaws and desires, ambition, but more than anything, heart and a deep sense of community, because it's a reflection of where we will go in our society and by who we give our young people to emulate. And so that remains our goal.
And certainly this graphic novel could not be available in full at a more important time in our culture. And before I open up to questions from the audience, I'd like to recommend that we're going to continue this conversation at the Society of Illustrators on Wednesday with an event called March, The Power of Student Voices, where we are going to be joined by activist Abena Hutchful and Jonathan W. Gray and cartoonist Kai Texel to discuss how we as teachers, how we as educators can empower the next generation to be heard, and how this graphic novel serves as a guidepost for that movement. So I encourage you all to join me there. We have programs, flyers on your way out here. But you've heard from us. We would like to hear from you. Do you have any questions for Andrew and Nate down front?
I had a question about a specific sequence in the book. I think it's in book three, where you're telling the story of the 1963 church bombing that killed those four girls. And you're telling this really horrifying story, but in a way that you want a child to be able to read. I was just curious if you could say something about the thinking that went into how that was done.
It was a Sunday school lesson.
Let me unfold that. Let me unpack that
here
just a second.
Did everybody hear the question?
No, he's answering. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the question is, how do we approach the bombing in 16th Street Baptist Church in a manner so that March Book 3 is roughly intended for folks who might be 15, 16 and up. Like my 6-year olds read the first two books. So we're always riding this line. I think a lot of it has to, before you're talking about its reception by young readership, at the drawing table, I think that was determined by understanding my work's relationship to the victims and to their surviving family members. I wound up watching that Spike Lee documentary about the bombing. Just to get some likenesses, and I wound up getting some personal details that are just in the muttered text that had to do with things that were happening with those with the teenagers' personal lives. Where one was an usher that day, but it was her first day as usher, and she was nervous that she was going to mess up, and that was 15 minutes before the church service started. Another was in the marching band for her school, and their first game was happening. I guess it would be the next night, the Monday night. And discovering these things that were on these people's minds, and to be frank, one of the things I wanted to disrupt in telling that chapter of history was something that that ruffles my feathers a little bit, and I'm guilty of this too, is the use of the phrase, that killed those four little girls. And there's nothing wrong with it, but we all say it. It's an accepted part of the narrative of the civil rights movement. But it's important to understand these are 14 and 15 year olds. And they have, 8th, 9th, and 10th grade interests and lives. And it wasn't until I was actually able to see these interviews with their sisters, their parents, that I was able to perceive some of this personal life and realize I had an obligation to insert some of that I literally phoned it in. I just watched this documentary. I just want you to know, did you know this? I'm just going to throw this in there. And you're like, go for it, man.
When there was the whole drama of trying to find the lesson.
Oh, right, yes.
And we had to find it from that NPR article
To wrap my comment up,
yeah.
I think, that determined the tone where, clearly, again, it was a line of, accurate, responsible representation that wasn't exploiting, this act of violence. But that was still doing it in an unflinching way. The visually speaking, the smoke involved in the setting helped a lot. And obviously, it's weird to talk about things in that term, but we are because we're talking about making the comic. So that helped execute this in a way that was palatable for an audience that would be slightly younger. But I think having the tone set by personally feeling it was imperative to flesh out extra dimension to the lives of these four teenagers and sort of undercut the four little girls component of the popular narrative helped make the more awful parts of that scene bearable and justifiable to execute.
I mean, the question in writing that to me was... What can we bring to the story that is new and different? And to me, the biggest horror of that moment was the pain that their mother went through being in that church just above where the bombing took place. And so that's why we chose to tell it from her perspective. influence of my mother on my own writing style, where I was like, that is the most painful, horrific thing I could imagine. Then there was a question that you brought up of, as we're depicting where the mother is, because it's always from the basement. You always hear the basement part. You never hear what's going on up above.
But from a directorial standpoint, we had to follow the mom.
Right.
So it was a rabbit hole. We went down a rabbit hole of questions to be able to directorially complete the scene.
Right. And then it became, what was the Sunday school lesson? And then the Sunday school lesson was just gut-wrenching. You're like, you can't make this up.
Well, and this is where the process of making March changed over the course of 4 years. It's like, we could not find what the actual Sunday school program was for that Sunday. And so I was like, well, you guys, I have a couple of ideas that I think would be strong or appropriate. What do you think about, this from the Sermon on the Mount or whatever? And you and Lee were both like, March is in a different place. We can't just make stuff up anymore. Like, we don't know it. We can't just insert, we can't write the sermon. But then, was it Lee or you?
No, I found it in NPR.
It was an NPR interview.
Again, audio only.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sermon.
Yeah. This is part of like the digitization of like these accounts, but also where stuff is fresh enough that it hasn't been transcribed into text only by listening to the audio file.
Well, and this is also an interesting thing that I don't think I've ever really talked about in context, but because all of the books came after the major anniversaries, people were bringing all this sort of stuff to the forefront, like they were digitizing and all sort of stuff. So a lot of the books that came out around the anniversary, they were all versions. And then because we were coming after, we could survey everything. So the NPR story may have come out in 2011, or I think that NPR story actually was on the 45th anniversary, so it would have been 2008. And then with the 50th anniversary of a lot of these, and people would find new documents, or the attention to it would cause people to reach out to a librarian and things like that. And we really benefited from being able to do that, whether through the digitized resources or simply the mass interviewing that went on with a number of these people. And we continue to benefit from that. I'm working on the period from 66 to 68, and now I'm just watching all of these RFK and Dr. King documentaries that are coming out now as people have gone around and done their recollections.
So we only have about 5 minutes left, so we're going to go into the lightning round with the questions. So please be mindful of being brief with your question, and we'll be mindful of being brief with our answers. And there was one on this side first.
Andrew, we remember our time when you were at the Strand Bookstore with John Lewis. We'd like to share the time to tell us about which he told us about how you tried to pitch, March to the various cargo companies. You turned them down because they were too corporate.
So the question is, how did you pitch March to various comics publishers? Thank you.
Well, so, first, I got turned down a lot by a lot of the publishers, right? I mean, everybody was... I actually almost got a green light. I was just talking about this with Paul Levins. I had pitched Vertigo for the first time. They were the original pitch, and Karen Berger was into it. And then Paul Levitz greenlit it, and then everybody got pushed out of DC. Jim Lee took over and was like, March, and killed it. So I'll definitely never get to work with Jim Lee. Never say never. Well, I'm here, man.
I'm sorry, I need to get somebody else.
Yeah.
Okay,
I was just wondering, like, if you had started writing the book today, in this political climate, would you think it would have been very different, or would you think it would still stay rather similar?
So, I think actually the biggest difference if I tried to write it today versus if I tried to write it those 10 years, Lord help. I was young and optimistic and full of hope and full of energy and all of this sort of stuff. And it's not that I'm not hopeful anymore, but I've just been through so much. And then to lose my mother this past summer, like, I don't think I could do it. I don't have the spirit right now. I'm struggling to get through anything I'm doing right now. My mom is gone. My life is sort of in a way over. Everything I was doing was to prove it to her. If you watch my National Book Award speech, first thing I say is like, Mama, we made it! And she was so sick, she couldn't even be there for that. And so I don't know if I would have the energy and the heart to be able to sign up for another 10 years, you know?
How do you submit your work to the publishers?
That's a very general question, so we'll come up with us afterwards and we'll speak about that. I just want to get questions about Mark.
It's usually just email.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Okay, is there down here?
You mentioned that this was your first book. How did that feel, taking on such a really, sensitive issue? Did you feel like you were biting off more than you could chew, or that this wasn't your place?
No, I mean, this goes back to the other day. I was so young, I felt like I could do anything, you know? And that's why I always go back to how powerful young people are. They're at this moment in their lives, and then we get beaten down by life. And it doesn't mean we can't be hopeful. John Lewis is hopeful to this day. He's so optimistic and everything like that. But we develop, it's the creeping sense of fear, right? I mean, could I have risked everything? The thing that folks, like, really, really was the dumbest thing I did is that the first 3 years of March, before, like, anybody was behind it, I paid for it all with student loan money. So not only if this failed would I embarrass myself, but then I'd be broke for the rest of my life too. And it was so much, I didn't actually pay it off until the third book came out. So I had to win the National Book Award to pay off my student loan debt. Like, that's, but that's where we are as a society too right now, which is even more messed up. But yeah.
Any ladies with questions? Okay.
What can you tell us about Ron?
Hey, it's going to be good. I'm really excited about it. We just did editing pass this morning down in the lobby, if anybody saw me sitting down there. I'm excited.
Behind you.
Oh, I'm curious to know whether John Lewis himself read the book, and what did he think of it?
Yeah, I mean, he was reading the scripts, too, which is hilarious to see John Lewis reading a comic book script. Right? Because then he gave me this call. Panel 4, and you're like, it's just surreal, right? But, like...
Well, from my standpoint, to me, to condense it to one anecdote, it was when the third book was finished, and we rushed off copies of the printer right under the wire, getting the finished physical book. I mean, he was looking at it throughout while the art was coming in. But he called me when he got the book and he had read it, and, you know, every once in a while, it's always nice when the phone rings and you see John Lewis's face on the screen. Yes! but, you know, like this time, you know, like he called to tell me how that he'd read the book and that it was very moving, but, like, you know, Congressman, he plays a tight game. He keeps his emotional cards really close to his chest and everything. He keeps it really cool. But there was a little bit of just this tremor in his voice. And there are times when it's a weird responsibility to visually convey his memories and his experiences. And so there are these times where, like, a lot of the intensity of what happens in the third book, you know, like as we were talking earlier, like in a lot of ways, like John Lewis does, like he time travels. Like, he experiences our world, and he experiences the breadth of his personal experiences simultaneously. He lives the spirit of history, and he really means that. But the ways in which he was reckoning with where he had come from, and where we had all come from, and were headed towards, and resisting against, and jumping past, it was just really evident, just in this, like, tremor in his voice, and the way that he was, you know, conveying that, like, I hit the nail on the head as an artist. And it's like one of the greatest moments of my life was getting that book 3 phone call from him. Just like, you made something, you know, like you did well.
Well, I remember you being in Ohio State when we did the event there, and showing him the pages from book 2.
Right.
And it's when he gets beaten at the Montgomery bus station, and he just started crying on you.
Yeah.
It's on camera somewhere too.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing these remarkable memories and your experience in making this remarkable graphic novel trilogy. Let's have a round of applause.
OK, Kay. We are ending the day at Mocha Fest. We are walking around with Andrew
Iden,
to make sure I say it right, the co-author of the trilogy March. It was a great panel that we got to sit in on. Thank you very much for your panel and all the information you bestowed on us.
Well, thank you so much for being there.
My wife is a huge fan of the March trilogy, and I was able to convince her to come to Mocha because I said the creators of March are going to be there with a panel, so she was absolutely thrilled about that. So thank you guys for being here.
That's so awesome. I love that.
So you obviously, were you a comic book fan growing up?
Yeah, I was pretty hardcore. My first comic was Uncanny X-Men 317, the Phalanx Covenant with the lenticular cover. Oh. I got it off a spinner rack at Piggly Wiggly in Western North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
And after that, I was hooked.
So what, was it the cover that got you hooked on it, or was it the fact that you just liked the idea of superheroes?
You know, what it was is my father left when I was very young, and so I was always craving stories about people who wanted to do the right thing, because I always felt like the world was inherently an unfair place. And so I wanted to read stories about people who are trying to do good, who are trying to right wrongs. And I found that in comics. I mean, at the time, it was a lot of white men in spandex, but that was what I could get, and that was the best that was out there. And so that's sort of how it hooked me.
Yeah, but and the X-Men's a good choice, too, because they were people who were always considered different, right? And
exactly.
If you were going to find diversity on a team, the X-Men was the team to go for.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So were you an only child growing up?
Yeah, only child.
So just you and your mom?
Just me and her. We were a pair. We were a team.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I'm very close with my mom, too. I'm her only son, so that bond, I totally understand it. What was her influence on you in regards to the direction that your career or your even schooling would take? Because you said that you had a scholarship, so you did really well in school.
I went to college on a scholarship, which is probably the only way we could have afforded for me to go to college. But, you know, my mom's influence on me was profound, because so much of what I was willing to pursue in my life came from her first insistence that I learn the value of hard work, that I be working all the time, and that I come to figure out that work can be enjoyable, right? That actually what sucks, for lack of a better word, is to not have something to do, and that the best thing is to have something important to do. And so a lot of that was, a core part of my growing up. And then she was always hospitable to me pursuing comics. I mean, she let me go to Dragon Con by myself when I was like 13.
Wow.
Right? That's a bold woman.
Yeah, by yourself?
By myself, yeah. She went with me the first year. She was like, it's a little weird, but if you're into it, it's fine. And I went basically every year since. And, you know, she was always... There was something that she would say is that she wanted me to be able to do something with my life that I would enjoy, but that would mean something.
Wow.
It was never accepted in my household that there was anything called good enough. It was, did you do the best? Did you keep working at it until it was right? You know, and that's just always been my work ethic. Because of her, the things she used to do is that my mom was a gardener.
Where was your mom from?
She's from Atlanta.
Okay.
Yeah, born and raised. My mother's from Atlanta. My grandmother's from Atlanta. My great-grandmother's from Atlanta.
Okay.
On my mother's side, that is.
Right.
Yeah. But my mother was a gardener, and so every Saturday and every Sunday, we got up early because it's hot in Georgia summer to work in the yard. And we would work for hours, digging holes, planting, mowing, edging, all this sort of stuff. And it just built in me this habit of, like, weekends are not a time to lounge around. It's just when you work on other stuff, which is the same sort of, it's how I had to be to get March done. There was no downtime. There was no free.
You had a day job, right?
Right.
An important day job.
Yeah. I mean, I started in the congressman's office answering mail, and by the time I was working on March, I'd taken over all of his social media accounts, and I was doing all sorts of stuff, been writing speeches and just things like that. Took on a policy portfolio because, I mean, I always believed in the power of government, but that it should be used to help the people who need it.
Right.
I think all too often government can be manipulated, particularly these days, against the people who need it the most. And, you know, you know it. You grow up with a single mom. You have this inherent sense of injustice and this drive to right those wrongs.
Right, right. So looking forward now, you go a couple years, and your mom would be extremely proud of everything that you have done, I imagine. What was her reaction when she saw the success and the response of March?
I mean, Mama was thrilled. She loved it. She ate it up. She followed every detail. She claimed, like, up until the day she died, that the framing device for March of President Barack Obama's inauguration was her idea first.
Really?
And I will give it to her.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so she was involved in so much of it just as my sounding board because, you know, I mean, she and I talked every day. Any idea I had, I ran by her. And, you know, I remember asking her after we won the National Book Award, I was like, Mama, you know, you've been my mom a long time. In all those years, did you ever think that I would do something like win a National Book Award? And Mama says, honey, I love you. I love you with all my heart. But no.
No one's honest like your mom, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And that to me, though, is like the highest compliment. The idea that I surpassed my mother's wildest dreams for me.
Right.
And to have been able to do it before she passed.
Yeah.
You know, that's all we can hope for as children.
That's a gift. That's a gift. Yeah. So how did you take, you know, having your love of comic books and you're in a serious job working for the congressman, how were you able to pitch the idea to him to tell his story through a graphic novel format?
Well, it was the summer of 2008. I was working on his reelection campaign, and it was coming down to the end of the campaign, and folks were talking about what they were going to do afterwards. Some folks said they were going to go to the beach. Some folks said they were going to go see their parents. And I said I was going to a comic book convention. It was Dragon Con. And everybody started laughing at me, like all these people on the campaign. And the congressman said, you know, don't laugh. There was a comic book during the movement. It was very influential.
Right.
And I was like, wow, that's amazing. So I went and I looked up this comic, Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story, on the internet. And I was captivated by it, you know. I mean, it was beautiful. It's this 50s house style. It was done it was just very well done. And so I'm sitting there reading this, and I just spent the summer on his campaign hearing all these stories that I'd never heard as a kid about SNCC, about the young people. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Atlanta. Congressman Lewis had been my congressman since I was 3 years old.
So you felt like I should have known this already.
Yeah, why did I not know this? And so I'm sitting there looking at the comic book, and I'm thinking about all these stories and how great they are. And I'm like, why doesn't John Lewis write a comic book?
Yeah.
That seems like a... So then the next day, we go back, and one of the big conversations during that campaign was, how does John Lewis reach young people? How do you teach the story of the movement to young people?
Yeah.
And everybody had these weird ideas. Oh, you should make a movie about it. I'm like, yeah, that's not a bad idea. But, you know, you got to get $20 million. Okay. So, well, like, you know, we could make a pamphlet. We could go on a speaking tour, like all these different random things. And I raised my hand, and I'm like, I think you should do a comic book. And again, everybody, there's this like dead silence.
What's
as everybody like looks like, did he really just say that, you know? And they move on without even responding. And so, but the question kept coming up. And I just kept saying, no, really, I think he should do a comic book. And I made my case, and over time, I sort of talked to the congressman about it. And he would be really sweet about it, and he'd be like, oh, well, maybe.
Yeah,
but I was like, not going to take maybe, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I kept going, until finally he said, okay, I'll do it, but only if you write it with me. And then, you know, how do you go from there to making it? And it was sort of this...
Did you have the idea to want to write, like, when you were pitching, you were like, I want to write his story? Or were you thinking, maybe we'll hire somebody to write his story?
Nobody else wanted to write it. Nobody else could write it. I mean, he had such trouble finding someone to help him write his first book that, you know, it was like me or nobody.
That's so strange.
You know?
Especially in this day and age. Like, you guys were making that book while so many movies highlighting that era, like Selma had, was being
made. Selma didn't come out until, like, 2015.
Right, that's true.
So, and that's the thing, right? We were in this period of time where, like, all these young people, they had no idea who John Lewis was.
Yeah.
All these people broadly didn't know who John Lewis was.
Right.
And so I had responsibility of two things. One is the graphic novels. We have to make the graphic novels to tell the story. The other is social media. So I made hashtag Good Trouble and spent a good bit of my time taking a lot of the photos and videos and things that I found and integrating those into his social media platforms to tell the story much in the same way, just using technology.
Right.
And now you see hashtag Good Trouble everywhere.
That's
that's amazing. So, but it worked, right? Like, yeah, now everybody knows who John Lewis is.
Yeah, and for me, I think, like, I've seen the movies. My wife is she follows all the civil rights movements, read, you know, autobiographies of so many of those peoples. But March for her stood out. And even when I think about Selma and I'm like, oh, look, we know who that is now because of the book.
Right.
But I find the graphic novel still to be a more powerful storytelling way to, like, there's so many things that you guys are able to capture in that book emotionally and historically that you can't really do in a 2-hour movie.
Right. I mean, comics have a power to tell stories in a way that resonates more deeply than I believe any other medium.
And you can take things at your own pace. Like, you can look at a certain page and enjoy it as long as you need to.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, for this generation especially, they're digital natives. They've grown up on the internet.
Right.
They speak in words and pictures. A comics panel is basically a meme. That's why you see so many comic artists having these large presence on the internet. But the underlying theory is that if you want to reach young people, you have to do it in their language.
Right.
And that's why you use comics.
So now that you are in the...
It's not going to be just young people. This generation is going to grow up. And comics are going to become a major force in our literary world.
And it's important that, I think, too, people realize that there's valuable educational things that people can read. It's not just about the stuff that maybe people assume comic books are. But there's something you can teach kids in school through the graphic novel format.
Right. Well, I love to tell this story. You know, when I was a kid, I would bring my comics with me to class, and I'd read them before class or after class. And I can remember one time my English teacher caught me with my comics out on my desk when class started. And she was like, "You can't have those comics out. They're not real books."
Right.
But I got to go back to my high school.
Right.
And I got to speak with that very same English teacher about her experiences teaching March in her English class.
And I
don't tell that story as any form of comeuppance to the teacher because, frankly, she was expressing the prevailing wisdom of the time.
That's right.
But it does say something about the power of an idea whose time has come, and the brief period in which change is possible.
Right.
You know?
That must feel so good, though, to be able to bring something back to the school where you grew up. And that original thing you loved that maybe at that time was like, oh, look at this silly kid, you're changing history. Just getting him to say hello to somebody.
Yeah, Dean Haskell.
Hey, what's up?
Hi, nice to meet you, Dean. I'm Eric. We're just interviewing a podcast.
Oh, you're on the podcast. Really? Oh, sweet. Okay.
We call it a pod bomb.
A pod bomb?
Pod bomb. Instead of
I like
bomb.
It. I like it. Congratulations, man.
Thanks,
one?
Man.
Is that the next one?
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome,
yeah,
dude.
It's coming together. I just did a pass through on the layouts this morning, and I'm really excited.
Oh, that's Afua Richardson?
Afua Richardson,
Afua.
Yeah.
She is I met her at Baltimore Comic Con. Not only is she a sweetheart, but she's so uber talented.
Right.
And homeboy Nate's taking a break, or is
he's doing the first 10 pages?
Oh, okay. Is it like a transitional type thing?
Yeah.
To kind of like
it's a throw to the new artist
for the eventual 6-volume omnibus. Is that what it's going to be? Is that
I'm
how
not
it works?
Signed a contract, but for 2 more. That's all I'm undergoing.
No, but I mean, if you put them all together,
yeah, it's possible.
You got that little 10-page like leeway, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
It hands the baton.
That's right.
The baton over like
yeah.
That's pretty. Smart,
I think this is. I think this may end up being the biggest book illustrated by a woman of color.
Oh, that's probably absolutely. You know,
so I'm really excited about what she's doing. I mean, she's just her layouts have gotten to be incredible. She does amazing likenesses.
Yeah,
she's got a.
Well, that's key because I mean, that's what if you were going to ask me to do, I'd be like, thanks, but I can't rock the likeness. You know, like that's pretty hard.
Well,
and that's what people expect when you're going to pick up a book like that is you know you're going to meet certain characters in real life. But when I did The Alcoholic with Jonathan Ames. And I was doing his semi-life story, and it was going to go from child to adult. I knew that I had to draw the nose the same way.
Right.
So you identify him through this nose that I drew. You know, that was my shortcut, you know? But in this case, she's taking from March and up to date. Is that the idea?
Well, this next volume is going to take place from August 8th, 1965, to June of 66 in the first use of Black Power during the Meredith March.
Got it. Okay.
So that's going to be just the first one. The next one will probably be from 66 to 68.
Okay.
Depending on how much space and how much time they give me.
Yep.
But I keep have this bad habit of them being like, okay, it's going to be one book. Give us 150 pages. And then I turn in 200 and something.
Okay.
And they're like, what do we cut? And I'm like, I don't know. It's up to you. You're the editor.
That's your job.
And then they go, well, why don't we just break it up? I'm like, all right.
Okay.
So that's what happened this time, too.
Awesome. So you have two, and then not is going to not going to be another trilogy, or you know?
I mean, I don't know yet.
Just write a lot. You'll get your trilogy. All right, so by the time that all gets wrapped, we're talking 2020.
Fiction book.
Come on.
Yeah.
Who's drawing?
I don't know yet.
So you're developing it right now.
It's been sold to Abrams.
What?
Yeah.
I'm looking at a rock star, guys.
We're talking to a rock star.
But it's about a political campaign.
It's about a political campaign.
But in the modern area, yeah. So that I can talk about things without actually talking about people.
Thank you. Well, that's what we do.
Right.
That's what I do. That's pretty awesome, man.
I'm excited.
Oh, but I have a feeling that if you're writing it, people are going to know what the hell you're talking about.
I hope so.
Okay.
I'm excited.
That's awesome. All right, man.
But we should
get
together soon.
No, absolutely. Are you in a city? I forget.
No, I live in D.C.
You're in D.C.
But
you're
I come not, up and go.
Are you here this week?
I'm here till tomorrow.
All right, never mind. I have a play launching on Tuesday for a week.
Congratulations.
But if you're not
What's it called?
It's called The Last Bar, The End of the World. And it stars Seth Gilliam from The Walking Dead and The Wire and Stoya, international porn star.
Awesome.
And it's a existential tragic comedy about a dying cartoonist.
Oh,
and it's
cool.
April 10th to the 15th at Urban Stages.
That's awesome. Congratulations, man.
All right, man.
And I hope everybody listening goes into it, too.
Yeah, thank you very much. All right, guys. Good talking to you. All right.
Nice to see you.
So that's what happens at these shows. It's great to just get to see everybody, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't get to... I haven't been on the road for a year and a half since Mama got sick.
Oh, wow.
So this is my first... Last weekend was my first show back in more than a year. And this is my first time seeing the indie comics community... And like it's like coming back home to family.
Well, you gotta come to Toronto then. That's where I'm from actually. So they got TCAF there, which is a huge
man. I'll be there.
I'm sure they'd love to have you there, man.
Oh, I'd love to be there.
Yeah, if you can make it, it's May 12th.
Okay.
I don't know if that's your schedule's already booked, but that would be a great privilege to have you there. So what are you working on next?
So I gotta finish this first volume of Run.
Okay.
And then I'm gonna write my own fiction book.
Does that have a title?
Right now, it's just the working title of the teacher story.
Okay, okay.
So I don't know what it'll end up being, but
we don't want no spoilers yet.
The teacher story, and it's always still the teacher story. No one's come up with anything better.
Okay, so what is Run going to? So we heard you talk about it a little bit with the gentleman.
Yeah.
So with Dean, what's his full name again?
Dean Hashbeal.
Dean Hashbeal. So we're all going to look that up and make sure we know who Dean is. So it's going to continue from where March left off?
Right. It picks up 2 days after the end of book three.
Okay.
Because
it's continuing Congressman Lewis's life.
Right. You know, we end book three, and the congressman says, and he believes that the movement ended with the signing of the Voting Rights Act. And what Run picks up with is the fight to execute the protections of the Voting Rights Act and the fight against using those protections by the white supremacist power structure. And it was very real and very immediate. I mean, it was 2 days after the signing of the Voting Rights Act that you had the largest hooded Klan march that you'd had in decades in Georgia. And they were marching. They were using nonviolence in the way that the movement had. They had studied their opponents. And I think it will provide an important context for people who are sort of saying, when did this start, right? When did all this voter suppression start? When did the attacks on voting rights start? When did all this moving around the polling places and all these sort of shenanigans we see in elections today? And it started right after that. And in fact, it never stopped. They were doing it before the Voting Rights Act, and the Voting Rights Act is a tool to limit them. But, you know, it also makes the case that we could be doing much more.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to give March a run of relevance on its own outside of March, because we have to understand how we got to where we are right now with our politics. And this is one of those moments that's not very well studied, not very well understood, and hopefully we'll be able to shine an important light on it.
Yeah, and I don't live in the United States, too, but we follow a lot of the news that happens here because it does affect the rest of the world in a big sense. So being so closely in concert with Congressman Lewis at this particular time in history where so much of what he experienced and fought for, it's almost like history repeating itself. What are his feelings, if you're able to speak on it?
You know, I think the congressman feels that this is a dark time. But he's going to be the first to remind you that we've still traveled a great distance.
Okay.
And, we still had Barack Obama as our president. We still made tremendous progress in many areas.
Right.
And I think, speaking for myself at the very least, like these young people that I think we played a role in helping agitate and inspire, their cause to give us all hope. Because this is long overdue. And these young people standing up now and speaking up and marching and protesting, I think we're witnessing the beginning of a new nonviolent revolution. And they've clearly studied the movement. I know a lot of these kids have read March. I saw a whole lot of hashtag good trouble signs at these marches. And I can't help but think that they are John Lewis's children. And that they will bring us to a better place. History's never a straight line. Progress is never a straight line.
Yeah. Well, I can't think of a better way to end it on that. Thank you so much for your time. It was a great pleasure to meet you. I hope you make it to TCAF and we run into each other again.
Yeah, me too, Grant. I appreciate it. Thank you for your time, and thanks for coming to the panel.
We will not stop all of the forces of Eastland. Barnett, Wallace, and Thurman will not stop this revolution. If we do not get meaningful legislation out of this Congress, the time will come when we will not confine our marching to Washington. We will march through the South, through the streets of Jackson, through the streets of Danville, through the streets of Cambridge, through the streets of Birmingham. But we will march with the spirit of love and with the spirit of dignity that we have shown here today. By the forces of our demand, our determination, and our numbers, we shall splinter the segregated South into a thousand pieces and put them together in the image of God and democracy. We must say, wake up, America, wake up, for we cannot stop, and we will not and cannot be patient.
Every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. No one can win a war individually. It take the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory, the coming of the Lord. My eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes,